Welcome to Broken Law, brought to you by the American Constitution Society, a 501c3 nonprofit, nonpartisan organization. I'm Beth Binchik, Director of Policy and Program at ACS. From unprecedented levels of wildfire smoke blanketing much of the U.S., to record-breaking heat, to a tropical storm that brought devastating rains to California, to catastrophic wildfires in Maui, this summer has had no shortage of extreme weather events. These events have in turn brought increased attention to the issue of climate change. But as our understanding of climate change and the field of extreme weather attribution continue to advance, the question remains, can the law keep pace with science? Here to help us understand where science meets the law is Michael Berger, the Executive Director of the Sabin Center for Climate Change Law. Michael is a widely published scholar and leads a dynamic team that is at the forefront of efforts to reduce greenhouse gas emissions and promote climate change adaptation. Mike, welcome to Broken Law.
Great to be here. Thanks, Beth.
So the Sabin Center maintains climate change litigation databases. Can you tell us when you began tracking climate change litigation?
The Sabin Center first launched what was at first a PDF with links in it, and it was called the Climate Case Chart in its initial rendition back in 2009. And over the course of time, we've evolved from a 150-page PDF that you had to scroll through to find cases that fall into different categories to the searchable, highly easily navigable database that we have today.
And how many cases are you tracking right now?
There actually are two databases. We have one database that has cases filed in the United States and one database that has cases filed everywhere else. And at this moment in time, I think we're over 2,300 cases altogether filed worldwide.
It's a lot to keep track of. Can you tell me how the Sabin Center defines climate change litigation?
Yeah, it's an interesting question, and it's one that is subject to some amount of academic and practitioner, dispute and discussion. There are any number of ways that one could define climate change litigation. For the purposes of maintaining our database, we define climate change litigation as lawsuits and other types of adjudicatory proceedings where climate change is a material issue of law or fact. That is, where climate change itself is a determinative issue on the facts or is a central legal question in the case. Now, what this winds up meaning is that we exclude a good number of cases that have obvious strategic or tactical or even just, kind of consequential consequences for climate change. The example I like to bring up most often is the Beyond Coal campaign. For a number of years, the Sierra Club led a campaign to shut down coal-fired power plants or increase the costs of operating them by seeking to internalize the costs of pollution through a range of Clean Air Act and Toxic Waste and Clean Water Act causes of action. Climate change was never central to any of those cases. It was oftentimes not even mentioned. But the entire campaign was kind of strategically oriented to combat climate change. None of those cases are in our database. We don't try and understand the implicit or even explicit motives of plaintiffs or the lawyers working with them. We really just focus on this question of whether climate change is a material issue in the case.
Climate change litigation seems to be spoken about more in media right now. Specifically, I'd say climate rights litigation. Can you explain what that subset is of climate rights litigation?
So, climate change litigation really covers a broad spectrum of cases. The vast majority of cases that we have in our U.S. database and a large number of the cases that fall into our non-U.S. database are cases that involve things like environmental impact assessments, so NEPA here in the United States, or the Endangered Species Act and biodiversity protection, or Clean Water Act cases, or cases that take place under a number of existing environmental, energy, natural resources, and land use laws. And oftentimes litigation involves an effort to kind of bring climate change to the fore in these existing statutory causes of action. Climate rights cases do grab a lot of media attention, in large part because they have the potential to kind of shift climate ambition at a national or subnational or even corporate level, depending on who the defendant in the case may be. In climate rights cases, typically, we're looking at cases that invoke either human rights, if you're looking in the international context or in some domestic contexts, or constitutional rights, that involve things like the right to life, the right to property, the right to privacy, and in a good number of cases, the right to a healthy environment. And so again, those can be inscribed in international human rights law, domestic human rights law, or frequently in national or subnational constitutions.
Well, I don't think we could talk about climate rights litigation right now without mentioning Held versus Montana, which was decided in the district court just recently. Could you give us some background about the facts of that case and what legal issues were at stake?
Held versus Montana was one of numerous lawsuits that have been brought by the organization, the nonprofit organization, Our Children's Trust, on behalf of youth plaintiffs here in the United States and elsewhere around the world, where youth plaintiffs are standing in both for themselves and to a certain extent for future generations to reflect the extremity of the climate crisis and the differential risk that it poses to youth and to the future as compared to even the extreme impacts that we're seeing today on a daily basis. Held was a case that was filed in the state of Montana, and it's a case that was brought against the state of Montana. And in its initial iteration, it involved a challenge to the state's energy policy, as particularly in regards to fossil fuel production, transportation, and consumption, as well as to a provision of the Montana Environmental Policy Act that provides for an exemption from environmental review that basically precludes the government from considering the climate change impacts of its fossil fuel permitting decisions. So the case went to trial earlier this summer, and it was heralded as the first constitutional climate trial in the United States. And in many respects, it was also the first trial of the contemporary era on climate change in the United States, where climate science and the stories of climate impacts were really put front and center. So in some respects, it was a big narrative case. It's a big story, right? We have kids suing their state government for its failure to even think about climate change and making some of the most important fossil fuel decisions of the day. And then at the same time, it wound up being a fairly narrow case that involved the question of whether or not the state's Green Amendment, a constitutional provision that provides for a right to a healthful environment, incorporates protections against climate change impacts, and whether that exemption to environmental review, that particular provision, violates the state's constitution.
Yeah, I think you had previously said that you expected this case would be a battle of the experts. Is that how the trial actually played out?
You know, no, not really. It didn't turn out that way. What wound up happening at trial was the youth plaintiffs got up on the stand and told their stories. And a good deal of the plaintiff's case involved kids telling stories about their lives and the impact that climate change is having on their mental health, their physical health, their feelings about the future, the prospects for their livelihoods, the water resources, the risk of wildfire, their experience with these kinds of extreme events. And so there was a good amount of time at trial spent with people telling stories. The plaintiffs also did put on an impressive range of expert testimony. So there were scientists who got up to talk about the basics and the fundamentals of climate change science, including detection and attribution science. They got up to talk about the range of impacts to natural resources, human health, communities, and individuals that are being experienced in Montana today. There were experts that got up to talk about the prospects and possibilities of enacting the energy transition, the transition from fossil fuels to a clean energy, both in the state's grid and in the state's economy in the state of Montana. And there were a number of other experts. I think those are maybe some of the big categories where we saw climate science and energy transition modeling and science sort of put up on the stand. The state did not really put up much of a battle at all. They only put up one or two witnesses, I believe, on the expert front. And their case boiled down to an argument that despite everything that the plaintiff's scientists had said, none of it really matters.
And can you explain that a little bit? I thought the, you know, none of it really matters took the tone of, well, you know, our greenhouse gas emissions are just a drop in the bucket. You know, what can Montana do? Is that right?
That's absolutely right. I mean, in when I think about this case, you know, on a poster, like, what is the fight here? What's the drama? What's the narrative? What's the storyline? It's the plaintiff saying every ton of carbon dioxide matters for our future, and the defendants, the state, saying nothing that happens within the state of Montana really matters for climate change at a global level or for the particular impacts that these kids are complaining about today. And that's not atypical. I would say actually it's typical for climate litigation. Defendants, whether they be national governments, subnational governments, or corporations, defendants being hailed into court, called to account for their climate action or inaction, regularly argue that whatever they're doing is insignificant on the global scale, and so they cannot be held legally accountable for it. It's kind of it's like a version of too big to fail, but in some other kind of, you know, contortion or formulation. And courts in the United States and worldwide have largely rejected those arguments. The idea that because this is a global phenomenon with global sources, that in some sense everyone contributes to, even though you can definitely identify the key decision makers who are most responsible for the state that we're in and for the crisis that we're in, because it's a global phenomenon, nobody gets to go to court to seek accountability. And courts just have not, for the most part, been buying that argument.
Yeah. And tell me about what the court did here with respect to that argument. I think, you know, the drop in the bucket argument comes up in a couple of places. You know, first, it comes up with respect to, you know, is the state of Montana really responsible for these harms? You know, did they cause it? But then it also seems to come up in terms of, well, if the court tells the state to do something with respect to their greenhouse gas emissions, is that going to have any real effect? So could you explain how the court attacked those arguments in this case?
Well, yeah. So the part of the argument was, the question was whether or not the plaintiffs have standing to sue, whether they can show a causal connection between the actions that were being complained of, which did eventually just, again, boil down to not the state's energy policy writ large and its kind of across the board support for fossil fuels, but really on this environmental review exemption, whether there was a causal connection between the state's decision making and the way in which it makes its decisions and the harms that they've experienced. And that's a critically important aspect of the court's factual findings. The court found that as a matter of fact, there is a substantial enough relationship between decisions made in Montana about fossil fuel production, transportation, and consumption, and the impacts that are experienced in Montana, a substantial enough contribution to allow the case to proceed. It's important because that question of, does action anywhere mean anything for particular impacts experienced anywhere, is a difficult scientific question. It's not like, this is not a toxic tort. You know, it's not a particular pollutant or a tobacco case. It's not a particular pollutant or chemical in one place causing specific harm in another place. You seek the pathway of exposure and transmission. It's a global phenomenon. So, you know, we're looking at an aggregate contribution leading to an aggregate set of harms that are experienced particularly by people in the places where they live. And so that the finding that that causal connection is substantial enough definitely is notable and is highly likely, I would say, to influence the way other courts and other judges look at that same question. It does boil down to this, back to this, you know, the storyline. Every ton matters. If Montana has higher levels of carbon dioxide contributions, then that's going to mean more global warming, and that's going to mean more intense and extreme and regular impacts in the state of Montana as elsewhere. The redressability part is another part of the standing analysis and another part of the court's question as to whether or not there's anything it can or can't do. And if the court can't do anything, if no order from the court could provide relief to the plaintiffs, then there's no case or controversy. The court determined that, you know, the plaintiffs had complained about a wide range of harms, as I mentioned before, including psychological harms, as well as physical harms, as well as kind of harms to livelihood. And the court determined that Montana, the state, exercising its due discretion in making decisions about fossil fuels, could alleviate the plaintiff's injuries. It couldn't do away with them. It can't cure them. It won't stop them from happening, but it can alleviate them. And that, again, comes back to this every ton matters idea. The impacts will be less if the Montana gives climate change the room it deserves and demands, thinks about the consequences of its actions, and potentially makes different decisions that could alleviate the plaintiff's harms.
So the district court had a 103-page findings of fact and conclusions of law. Was there anything that surprised you in that? I was happy to see just how detailed the court was in this document.
The findings of fact are extensive, you know, and I think that they're validating for the plaintiff's stories, and for really everybody who is experiencing both the physical reality of climate change in the current moment, as well as the psychological impacts of these extreme events and the impacts that they cause, as well as the future concerns about how bad is this really going to get. You know, I think that one of the things that jumped out to me beyond sort of the scope of it and the all out embrace of climate science and the rejection of climate denialism, because there was one expert who the state put on and the court found that expert not credible, you know, showing that courts will not give kind of hack science the same space that it will give to real science in the courtroom. You know, there was a long history of media doing this kind of, you know, equal presentation of denialism and science. And it never was the case that courts treated it the same way. And here we saw that fully fleshed out. But this recognition that psychological harm from climate change is a cognizable injury, I think is quite distinct and important given the amount of research that's being done in this area now, as well as the lived experience that many people are having right now to recognize that this is a real thing and it's a real harm, and that it's not just some far out environmental problem with some set of technocratic, you know, resolutions, and it's kind of all abstract. It's a very real lived thing.
Do you think the comprehensiveness of, you know, the court's findings of fact and conclusions of law will be helpful to the plaintiffs on appeal? I think we're all anticipating that this decision is going to be appealed.
Yes. I mean, the state has said it's going to appeal, and yeah, you have to think that that's what's going to happen. You know, the Supreme Court, the Montana Supreme Court's ability to undo the factual findings is limited. That's not the role of the appellate courts to undo trial court's factual findings. There has to be, you know, serious gross error in order for that to happen. And I think the state will be hard pressed to identify any factual finding in that decision that represents anything close to gross error. So that, the, you know, that those aspects of the decision seem, at least in my view, to be quite firm and on solid ground. I think the real question from my perspective is the legal conclusion. So the court determined that the Green Amendment, the constitutional right to a healthful, clean and healthful environment in the Montana Constitution, does cover climate change and does obligate the government to provide some greater level of protection, whether it be procedural or substantive, against climate impacts than the state was doing with this environmental review exemption. That's subject to de novo review. So, you know, the Montana Supreme Court will make its own determination as to whether or not A, the Constitution that, you know, covers climate change, and B, whether that means, if it does, whether that means that this particular provision is unconstitutional.
You're listening to Broken Law, brought to you by the American Constitution Society. If you're enjoying Broken Law, consider becoming a member of ACS today. You do not need to be a lawyer to be a member. As we discuss so often on this podcast, our laws and legal systems impact all of us. By supporting ACS, you support Broken Law, our work to diversify the federal bench, and our advocacy for Supreme Court reform. You also become a member of our nationwide network. Learn more about ACS by visiting our website at acslaw.org. And now, back to the conversation.
Montana is one of the few states that has a Green Amendment in its state constitution. Could you explain what Green Amendments are and how that was important in this case?
So, I mean, the Green Amendment, I don't know that every state would call it a Green Amendment, but whatever it is, it's a constitutional right to a healthy environment. I think that that's the simplest way to think about it. It's a provision that has been written into a state constitution that says, you know, the people of the state have a right to a clean and healthful environment, or a clean and healthy environment, or a safe environment, or something along those provisions. They, along those lines, they are articulated in different ways. And yeah, there are a handful of states, maybe six at this point in the United States, I believe, maybe a little bit more, that have these kinds of provisions. And undoubtedly, there are advocates, you know, environmental advocates and climate advocates who are considering whether to press for new ones now. But what's happening in the United States is not isolated. There are more than 150 countries around the world that have constitutional provisions providing for a right to a healthy environment. And those provisions are frequently invoked in these climate rights cases globally. And last year, in July of 2022, the United Nations General Assembly passed a resolution for the first time recognizing an international right to a healthy environment. So, you know, that's what these provisions are. They articulate a new-ish kind of right. It's actually been around for, you know, well over a quarter of a century at this point, half a century or so. And it's not unique to the United States in any way, shape, or form. It's actually relatively new in the United States compared to in other places. What these provisions do is, you know, they provide a substantive right, but they also give potential plaintiffs a legal hook. So this gives, you know, individuals and groups, well, really individuals, access to the courts to try new theories and to test, you know, the adequacy of government action or inaction when it comes to climate change or other environmental issues.
Yeah, as you mentioned, the idea of, you know, a right to a healthful environment isn't new globally, but is maybe a newer concept in the United States in terms of getting, you know, amendments into state constitutions. Do you think the decision in HELD is going to bring more energy in other states who might seek out amendments if they don't already have one?
Yeah, I mean, as I just said, I think that it will certainly empower some number of advocates who will look at this decision as evidence of the potential utility of, you know, advocating for adoption of a similar kind of amendment in their own state. At the same time, it'll empower opponents to be much more concerned about it and perhaps to, you know, allocate more resources to opposing any political movement to pass a new green amendment, given the potential for that to provide ammunition and new causes of action to activists.
Yeah, I think you've previously stated that policymaking legislation is probably the best way to deal with the climate crisis. Why is that?
Well, the climate crisis requires an across-the-board economy-wide transition away from the fossil fuel-based economy that the planet is currently, you know, embroiled in. And it also requires government-wide, across-the-board action to increase resilience and reduce vulnerability to the impacts of climate change that are happening now and will only get worse in the years to come. So this is the kind of, you know, authority that courts just don't have. A court can't actually direct the government to undertake the set of actions that are required to give the climate crisis its due attention. There are also, I mean, the other piece of it is that to do this, to move away from fossil fuels and to decrease vulnerability and increase resilience, requires significant investments of all kinds of capital, right? Financial capital, right, and political capital. Because these are tough decisions that have very real and very negative, often, impacts on existing interests, whether they be corporate and business interests or whether they be people who live, you know, in vulnerable communities who don't want to move to get out of harm's way. So there are a lot of tough choices to be made. And the political palatability of those decisions, I think, is best resolved through legislative process, which can then reflect, you know, a broader set of interests and ambitions than a court order where you're necessarily limited to the parties that are in the case and the lawyers that are representing them and the individual judge or small number of judges who actually get to decide.
Given the current makeup of Congress, it seems difficult to achieve federal climate change legislation. Have we seen any recent successes?
Well, of course. I mean, the Inflation Reduction Act is the single biggest piece of climate legislation in the nation's history. And the impacts of that legislation in terms of providing funding for energy transition and economic transition have already begun to be felt nationwide. So we're a year in, and the funds that are provided, the incentives that have been put in place are only beginning to sort of work out. But certainly that was a major legislative victory that represents an extraordinary opportunity for this country and the states and localities and communities within it to make real progress towards the move away from fossil fuels, increased resilience, and dealing with other aspects of the crisis. At the current moment, I'm not holding out much hope for further progress on the legislative front from Congress.
Yeah, the Inflation Reduction Act was an interesting combination of, I would say, climate policy and also economic policy. Can you explain how those are working together in that act?
Yeah, I mean, I think what we've seen with the Inflation Reduction Act, as well as with the infrastructure bill, which also has a good deal of funding that goes directly to combat the climate crisis in a variety of ways, more on the resilience front, but also with some amount of support for energy transition issues, is it a move away from the command and control approach, which has long dominated environmental law and regulation, towards a investment based approach. So it's all carrots and no sticks, as a way of getting over the political hump into a palatable set of solutions. So I think that's how do they work together? I mean, the Inflation Reduction Act deploys the tax code primarily to address the crisis and seek to reduce emissions by providing incentives for clean energy. There are some revisions to the Clean Air Act that are included in there as well, but it's not a regulatory piece of legislation. It is a tax and spend kind of piece of legislation.
Executive agencies have also addressed issues related to climate change, but in recent years, the Supreme Court's use of the major questions doctrine and its reluctance to defer to agencies has restrained administrative action. Could you explain what the major questions doctrine is?
It's a trickier question than it ought to be, right? Anything that's called a doctrine at the Supreme Court level ought to be pretty clearly articulated with clear applications. But I think one of the things that has caused such consternation and concern about the major questions doctrine is the fuzziness.
What is major? No one knows.
Exactly. So the major questions doctrine has been, what it actually is has been articulated in a number of different ways. I think perhaps the easiest way, and maybe the most accurate way to understand it, is as a clear statement rule. So it's a principle of statutory interpretation that says where an agency seeks to extend its regulatory authority into a new area and an area of vast economic and political significance, the court will look for a clear articulation from Congress of the agency's authority to do so. So, what is major appears to be what the court is calling of vast political and economic significance, but everything that federal agencies do is of vast economic significance. That's that we're a big country and there's a lot of economic significance to most of the things that federal agencies do when they regulate. And the political significance of things appears to be dependent on somebody making it political. And so the ability of one party or another or one constituency or another to be very vocal and politicize something, for instance, climate change, which was politicized for a year. I mean, the science of climate change was made a profoundly political issue for a quarter of a century or more, which is still remarkable. And it's remarkable that it persists to this day in various forms. It leaves a lot of authority in the hands of a small number of people to bring something to the Supreme Court's attention and change the balance of powers really between the courts and administrative agencies just by, rattling the cages and shouting from the soapbox about this or that issue. So, right, the instances in which the court may apply the major questions doctrine is an open question. We just don't know what the real limits to that are. The ways in which the court will apply it, whether it's a clear statement rule, whether it's something that will be used at step one or step two of Chevron, if Chevron survives, which it does not seem entirely likely that it will, or whether it's some other kind of thing. All of those remain unsettled issues, I guess would be the generous way to put it, or deeply and perhaps irreducibly ambiguous would be another way.
How has the court's use of the major questions doctrine restricted agency actions related to climate change?
Well, it's interesting because one of the court's major question doctrine decisions was West Virginia versus EPA, in which the court found that the Clean Power Plan enacted under the Obama administration was subject to the major questions doctrine, and that Congress did not clearly articulate the authority of the agency, did not clearly grant the agency the authority to do what it was seeking to do in that rule, which was ultimately geared towards reducing greenhouse gas emissions from existing power plants. It didn't actually constrain EPA's ability to do anything in that instance because EPA was not actually pursuing the Clean Power Plan. It had withdrawn that rule and was pursuing a different regulatory path under the Biden administration. So there was no actual rule on the books that the administration was seeking to pursue at that time. And in fact, the proposed rule to reduce greenhouse gas emissions from power plants that's now been published does not take the approach of the Clean Power Plan at all. So they issued this decision about the major questions doctrine on an issue that was arguably moot at the time that they issued the decision. It didn't have any practical effect immediately on the agency. Now, that said, I think that the doctrine and the court's deployment of it has likely, spooked the agencies, EPA among others. There's this uncertainty about whether taking bold, innovative action at the federal level will pass the Supreme Court's muster. And because of the ambiguity about the terms of the doctrine and the, I think, accurate and rightful concerns about the way in which it may be deployed politically by judges to just sort of shoot down, agency action that they don't like, agencies are probably constraining themselves to a certain degree based on concerns about the survivability of ambitious regulatory action.
Yeah, the EPA was involved in another case just this last Supreme Court term, Sackett versus EPA. Could you tell us what the Supreme Court did there with respect to the Clean Water Act?
Well, I mean, what the Supreme Court did was it dramatically reduced the federal government's authority and jurisdiction and authority over the nation's waters and reduced the ability of EPA and the Army Corps of Engineers to tackle the continuing water pollution crisis, that bedevils large parts of this country. Removing, I don't know the exact percentage, but removing from the federal domain a good amount of water that has been protected and ought to be protected from pollution.
Do you expect this trend of the Supreme Court choosing not to defer to agency interpretations to continue?
Yes. I think all observers would agree that trend is clear, and that there are upcoming cases where we'll see different aspects of the deference regime called into question and perhaps altered as a result. But the current court majority's antagonism toward federal regulation and the majority's kind of belief in different forces than federal regulation as being the appropriate way to address social problems and the real limits on government authority to address social problems is enacting a profound change to the way in which courts review administrative action across the board. And so, yes, whether it's deference to agency interpretations in the face of congressional ambiguity, or whether it's deference in the face of congressional silence, or whether it's just something that doesn't even explicitly enact those questions of ambiguity or science, but goes more to, is this a reasonable policy action or not? All of those seem to be fair game right now for this court.
Do you think the difficulty in, getting climate change legislation passed or, having executive agency action that, survives a court's review is what's driving some of this increase we're seeing in climate change litigation?
Well, I think in the United States, the number of cases has not been dramatically different over the last number of years. We've seen an overall uptick in climate litigation globally, and we're seeing more cases filed in more jurisdictions around the world, sort of bringing forth a wider range of causes of action. So more and more legal theories against more and more different types of defendants across the board. But in the US, which has always been by an order of magnitude compared to the second largest country, the place where the most cases are filed, we continue to see many cases being filed under environmental review statutes, under state and federal land use, energy, natural resource laws. And, you know, these efforts to mainstream climate change across the regulatory universe and to mainstream climate change into corporate activity definitely continue. And, you know, I think that some amount of that reflects a ongoing despair with the failure of governments, you know, in many places to, and companies in many places to adequately address the extent and severity of the crisis.
And globally, what trends are you seeing in terms of climate change litigation?
Globally, I mean, there are any number, and we've published a report recently with the United Nations Environment Program that sort of provides a much more complete articulation than I'm going to provide here on that. And I think that the link will be provided alongside this podcast. But, you know, I think a couple of the trends that we're seeing are an increase in these climate rights cases like Held versus Montana. And another notable one is greenwashing. We're seeing an increasing number of cases involving challenges to corporate misrepresentations or alleged corporate misrepresentations of the environmental benefits and climate benefits of their strategies, business plans, and activities. And then, you know, one that is maybe a little bit off the radar for some people, or for most people, would be these pushback cases. You know, so climate litigation is usually talked about from a kind of pro-climate, pro-environment plaintiff's perspective. And at the Sabin Center, we do try to combat that and, you know, assess things from a neutral perspective rather than from a pro-plaintiff's perspective. And that goes down to the articulation and identification of cases. West Virginia versus EPA is a climate case. And that was not a case that was designed to enhance climate action. It was designed to slow it down. And there are a number of litigation-based strategies that we are seeing where companies are using the courts to try to slow down or stop government action on climate. One way in which we've just started to see these kinds of cases is actually in the international investor-state dispute settlement domain. So international investors bringing cases against governments, challenging their climate policies based on the claim that those policies have negative impacts on their investments. And that can be something that has a range of different types of impacts for foreign governments, particularly in developing countries, where foreign direct investment is such an important part of the economic mix. And we, you know, those cases are brought in arbitration panels that are not necessarily public. And so we're just beginning to see these cases. They could have a potentially significant impact. I like to flag them. I don't know of how much interest they are to everybody, though.
Now, I really appreciate you bringing that up, because with cases being in arbitration and not necessarily public, it's hard to know about those. So for those that are interested in climate change and the law and want to take that next step, where can they learn more about these issues?
Well, I think the Sabin Center's website, of course, is a good starting point. When it comes to climate change litigation in particular, you know, we do maintain our databases at climatecasechart.com, and that's a good place to go to get access to original documents, the pleadings, the briefs for you know, all of the cases that we've identified around the world. And then I would also, you know, for sort of a high level survey of what's going on, I do think that our recently published UNEP report is a great resource that's accessible and provides a broad global view of the state of play.
Well, Mike, thank you so much for joining me in this conversation.
Well, thank you so much, Beth. It's been a real pleasure.
And thanks to our listeners for finding Broken Law. Summer is a great time to catch up on missed episodes. You can find our past episodes wherever you're listening to this one. If you're enjoying Broken Law, help us bring the show to more listeners by recommending it to a friend and leaving us a review. Also, make sure to follow us on social media. You can also find our episodes and show notes on our website, acslaw.org/podcast. Together, we'll speak truth to power about the law, whose interests it really serves and whose it does not.